Please be seated. Good morning. The next case on our calendar this morning is Wells Fargo Bank v. Premier One Holdings, case number 67873. Are you ready to proceed, Mr. Jacobs?
Yes, Your
Honor. Okay. And would you introduce your counsel at the counsel table, please?
Yes, Your Honor. Andrew Jacobs and Kelly Dove for the Appellant Wells Fargo Bank today, Your Honor. And I'd like to try, if I can, to reserve 4 minutes to reply, if that doesn't interrupt questioning.
You'll get 4 minutes at some point, maybe. You can reserve four. Ms. Dove, welcome. Go ahead, Mr. Jacobs.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court, Andrew Jacobs and Kelly Dove for Wells Fargo. I'm here to take a little bit of a different tack in what may look like a similar argument to prior arguments. I think that looking at this record closely before the argument, this is a case that really needs to go back because of commercial reasonability and the underdevelopment of the record more than anything else. However, we also have constitutional arguments that we would like to present to you, especially in light of the mere absence of responsive argument in the appellee's brief on the point. So, turning briefly to commercial reasonability, I think it's very consistent with the tenor of this Court's recent approach to these cases to look at that issue and to see that it really wasn't properly decided or developed below. That seems to be pretty clear here. Below, the summary judgment argument that occurred right after you'd issued the SFR decision, that argument below rested on the premise from their side that the bank wasn't even allowed to argue commercial reasonability and that through the SFR case you had for all time foreclosed discussion of commercial reasonability. That's kind of what they argued. And then you see that the order that comes out of the Court, going all the way back to the February 9, 2015 minute entry, doesn't really explain anything in a reasoned way about the Court's outcome. It doesn't reject that argument and have some better understanding of why they would win on commercial reasonability. It simply cited SFR, the Court's own minute entry. And neither the judgment that they prepared nor the judgment that our firm prepared deal with this issue. So there's really no basis here to think that the Court got it right as far as the Court may have adopted and been led into error by this false standing argument and also by the fact that it was new law. Shadowwood didn't exist. The Court couldn't have known at that point precisely what to do. So without casting any aspersions on that, this case would really need to go back on that basis. Also, you could...
Yes, sir.
You could look at it as just a simple...
So are you saying under Shadowwood it should be vacated and remanded for further development in the district court? Is that your first line of argument?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah. And I think that you see here that Rule 56 really was not complied with. They basically tried to collapse everything into one determination. And it may be an uphill determination for the bank to seek to overcome that. That may be the path in the law. But when you have the other...
Can you address what Premier seems to argue that the recitals in the deed maybe cover more than what the statute does, and should this panel, in an order or opinion addressing this question, interpret 116 and the multiple numbers afterwards that deal with the extent of the recitals in the statute and what they cover in a deed that is used for a sale?
I would really like to speak, if I could please, Your Honor, to the question of the recitals and why they don't work here. What's really interesting about
all of them or just some of them?
There's a critical absence that cuts throughout all of the recorded documents that I'd like to point to.
Okay.
And that would be my first line of response to that question, Your Honor. When looking at that, we see that the Court hadn't issued SFR yet. That came out in 2014, in latter 2014. Here, you have documents from 2012 and 2013 saying the first three, the ones that are recorded before sale, don't say that there was a mailing. They just mention the statute. They don't even say, I complied with the statute. But then you have your deed upon sale that says, I complied with laws. Now, at that point, this Court had not yet explained to the state of Nevada how these statutes would be interpreted. And although the recital says it complies with 62 through 68, it doesn't mention 107.090. Now, I understand that the immediate reaction to that is, but that's incorporated. And I would say that might have been a lot clearer to the state after September 2014 than it was in 2012. The recitals could have simply said we mailed it, didn't say that. The recitals could have said we complied with 62 to 68 and 107.090, which might be a good idea if you want to invoke a conclusive presumption to take away hundreds of thousands of dollars of property rights. But for whatever reason, it doesn't say that, And I think it's one thing to say that SFR can apply retroactively to cases pending on review. It's a very different thing to say that recitals by a litigant that happened before SFR necessarily meant mandatory notice under 107.090 when, number one, that clearly wasn't resolved until September 2014. Number two, there's a federal district court decision that says it's not resolved today. So I think it's unclear today. It was certainly unclear before September 2014. And if they just had recitals that said, I nailed it, I get it, that would be sufficient. If they had recitals that said 107.090, that would mean they thought it was incorporated and they did affirm they complied. But none of that's true here. So that would be my response to that particular question.
Doesn't that argument necessarily involve an interpretation, though, of the statute and what it embraces or doesn't embrace?
It absolutely does. But the point is that the court gave notice prospectively to the state that it has to follow this rule. And the speculators and the banks did not know what it meant at that time. So they could have expressly stated what they did and that would work. They could have expressly invoked 0.090 and that would have worked. And there's a way
if we interpret the statute as embracing 090, then that's what the law always was. We're just now interpreting it. So let's focus on the interpretation.
That's exactly right, Justice. That's what the law is, but this is actually a piece of evidence as opposed to law.
I get that.
Right, not being a prior case, and that's a distinction we draw, but I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. And when we look at this, in terms of commercial reasonability, their argument to the court that they got the decision out of below was that in light of SFR, it was impossible, this is at page 154 of the record on appeal, that there can be no fraud or oppression given SFR. If you have the deed, there just can't be fraud or oppression.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that conflicts with footnote 6. I mean, you couldn't have been clearer. You weren't foreclosing it. It may be hard, it may be uphill, but that's why you have trial courts to develop that. Instead of throwing cases out right away, which we've seen this court at times send them back and say, this wasn't well developed. We didn't see anything here. How do you know that there was nothing in this record? And they say, well, we didn't come in and show the presence of an issue of fact. And I would say that under Rule 56, they have to roll the rock up the hill under Rule 56 and show the absence. And they didn't try to do that because counsel below took the position that after SFR, there was simply nothing left to think about or litigate. And that was their tactical choice. And while the SFR decision is very good for that set of interest holders, it does not conclusively foreclose all manner of argument, which is unfortunately the position they took. So that's with respect to commercial reasonability in our position. As far as due process, I'll just skip to the nub of it because that's what's interesting to discuss is this question of the incorporation of 090 into 68. I think that's really where the rubber meets the road in terms of this analysis. And you know, former Chief Judge Jones in the Federal District Court has read your opinion, and I read your opinion, to leave that question open. The paragraph at page 411 that discusses the relationship between 090, it says that 090, it quotes the language from 68 and says that, you know, 090 is meant to be read as if. But then at the end of the paragraph, the court drops a C cite. The last sentence of that paragraph on 411, there's a cite, and the sentence before the C cite says that if the security interest holder asks for notice, then they get it. And at the end of that sentence, there's a C cite to 107.090, which sends a signal, at least to Judge Jones of the Federal District Court and to many in the jurisdiction, that it is not clear whether there is a complete incorporation of 090. And I think that that's also muddied a bit interpretively by the fact that 090 talks about giving notice to those interests that are junior, that are subordinate to the deed of trust. And that creates this weird interpretive issue where we actually own the deed of trust. And so we're saying the statute that's incorporated requires giving notice to us because we're junior to the deed of trust, except actually we own the deed of trust. So it makes the statute really kind of incongruous on its face, saying give notice to the juniors, but we're not junior. So that, to me, corroborates Judge Jones's pause at the question of whether this court has completely decided the extent to which and how 0.090 was incorporated through 68. I believe that issue is still live before Your Honors today. With respect to takings, they waived this. I mean, they really did not advance argument with authority about any of these points. And in Shadowwood, the court mentioned referring to a 2006 decision that would not receive argument on points that were not elaborated or cogently presented. This is basically a two-page brief in substance. And they also make a curious concession that there's no public purpose here at all. They say if there's a taking, well, there's no public purpose. And that actually inverts the law of takings. If there's no public purpose, then it is automatically unconstitutional, though that's a very high bar to fulfill, and the court might not interpret the statute that way. The Ninth Circuit in Rancho de Calistoga was very clear that a purely private purpose where the government effectuates a taking is automatically unconstitutional. But more to the point, their understanding of the takings law gives them no way of explaining Loretto, which is a big takings case, the 1982 case involving cable. And it's a case like a lot of delegated private takings cases. You know, power company comes out, takes stuff under government authority, some money goes back to who it's taken from. Loretto, the cable case, is like that. And in their world, where mere private party status as an HOA means you can't even think about takings, well, then that would mean that Loretto doesn't exist, because that's a delegated private taking, and that's a significant subtype of takings in federal takings jurisprudence. So they've waived the issue of takings, they've volunteered a concession that would be fatal to their case, that it's a purely private purpose taking, and their theory of takings, to the extent they have one, cannot encompass Supreme Court law such as Loretto. So if I could, I'd like to please reserve the remainder of my time to reply.
Of course. Yes, Mr. James.
Thanks very much, Your Honor.
Ms. Gilbert?
Good morning, Your Honor. Justice Carvacy, Justice Pickering, Justice Seda. May it please the Court. Jacqueline Gilbert and Zachary Clayton on behalf of Respondent Premier One Holdings. Joseph Hong is also here for Premier One.
Mr. Hong, welcome.
This is an interesting argument that appellant brings up, because they've actually waived it. This was a motion for summary judgment. Under 56E, to overcome summary judgment, they have to bring evidence. So let's take a look at what actually exists. The bank here has, while the granting summary judgment, the facts should be viewed in the light most favorable to the non-moving party, but it has to be viewed in the context of the presumptions that exist. And when there's presumptions, that shifts the burden to the non-moving party. That's under Yeager v. Harris. The presumptions that exist here in this case, first, and not a presumption, but the conclusive recitals as to noticing in default that are in the trustee's deed. The rebuttable presumptions that exist under statute, that a recorded title is presumed valid, that the foreclosure deed and the sale are valid under 47250, subsection 16 to 18, which says that these types of actions are done in the normal course and they are presumed to have been done correctly. A letter duly directed and mailed was received in the ordinary course of mail under 47250.13. So they have to prove that the non-existence of the presumed fact is more probable than its existence. They haven't done that. This was summary judgment. While this was before Shadowwood and shortly after SFR, Premier needed only to present its deed to say, I have a valid foreclosure deed from a valid foreclosure that has conclusive proof in it of certain things, and they need to come forward to raise the issue of fact.
What does the deed actually say that you're relying on?
The deed in this case says that there was a default, and let me grab my copy. I believe it's on page 9 of the record. 8 and 9 of the record.
The trustee's deed on sales,
A8 and 9,
yes,
record. It says that the default occurred as set forth in the notice of default election to sell. And it says that Absent Collection Services has complied with all requirements of law, including but not limited to the elapsing of the 90 days, the mailing of the copies of notice of delinquent assessment, notice of default, and the posting and publication of the notice of sale. These are the recitals that are required under 31164, if I'm not mistaken, and 66. So they have the recitals that were required. But to say that the buyer has to come forward and say that they sent all these things and prove that, I think shifts a burden that doesn't exist. Again, the sale is presumed valid. The sale is presumed to have taken place correctly. Otherwise, you're shifting the burden to everybody who shows up at a 107 sale, because they get the senior recitals, by the way, or an HOA sale, or any other foreclosure sale, and saying, you, if you want a quiet title in your name, you have to prove everything. And the presumptions really don't matter. This is supposed, these laws are supposed to protect a buyer from these things, so that if somebody who, somebody made a mistake, they go after those people, not the buyer at the sale. Otherwise, the very prices they complain of will continue. The very prices they contain, and if this court was to come up with something, some reasoning like that, that the buyer has to prove it if they buy at a foreclosure sale, then you're going to chill the bidding at 107 sales. I don't think that's the result that's intended here. And again, it's the same recitals.
So the evidence for the summary judgment was?
Here's the evidence for the summary judgment. Summary judgment was the deed. Here's the evidence before the court at that time. There was a deed of trust that was recorded after the CC&Rs. It included an ability to escrow funds for those things that might take precedence over it, like taxes, association dues. Had a planned unit development rider that says if you, the borrower, doesn't pay, we will or can. You don't have to. It's a business decision. But we can pay and add it to your loan. It had, we know there's a delinquency in the assessments. These are all the things that came, that were in their request for judicial notice. There was a record, there was a default by the borrower. There was a recorded notice of default. There was at least 90 days that passed. There was a recorded notice of sale. There was a sale on public auction where the price that was bid was about four times what the recorded notice of sale deficiency was. And there's a foreclosure deed with conclusive recitals. Under 56E, if they want to challenge the sale, they need to bring forth evidence. They need to bring it forth. An affidavit, something. They could have looked in the records and come up with, hey, we have no evidence that we ever got these notices. They didn't. They could have said we tried to contact the association. They didn't come up with any evidence of that. They came up with no affidavit. They said the statute's unconstitutional. It's a taking, and price alone is enough for you to unwind the sale. That's what they said. No evidence whatsoever. And this court should not send it back. 56E is clear. If the person responding on summary judgment does not bring an affidavit or some competent evidence that could be brought at trial, summary judgment shall be entered against them. They can't just do nothing. They didn't ask for 56F relief. They can't come to the highest court in this state and say, give us 56F relief. Let us do some discovery. Let us build a better record. They had that opportunity below. To say we didn't know we needed to do it is just disingenuous. Commercial reasonableness has been something that's been on the table since the beginning of these cases back in 2012, 2013. It's a footnote in the SFR. Obviously, it was something. To come and say now that we have to prove it was commercially reasonable, the buyer, when they can't turn it over on 16-5 because price alone was this panel, reaffirmed the reaffirmance in Shadowwood, that you need some type of fraud, unfairness, or oppression to overturn it, it's on the person who's challenging the deed to bring the evidence. They didn't.
I would agree, wouldn't you, Ms. Gilbert, though, that the recitals that are contained in 31166 are not as expansive as the instrument in this case. I don't think that the recitals that are discussed in the statute conclusively resolve the question as to whether or not the sale was proper. It addresses the question of whether or not the notice was given. It addresses the question of whether or not the 90 days elapsed. It addresses the question of whether there was a mailing of the notice. That's what 31161 provides. But it does not say that the deed by itself is a conclusive presumption that all aspects of the sale are approved.
Well, I didn't say that, Your Honor. I apologize if I said that. No, I'm saying there's other presumptions that go with these. Those are under 47.
Your point is that in response to the summary judgment motion, the bank offered nothing to refute any other aspect, even if the court were to conclude that the recitals in the statute are narrowly construed.
Even if we're narrow to simply the recitals that as they're set forth in the deed under the statute, that they would still lose. They have to bring forth competent evidence. A sale is presumed valid. The transactions are presumed valid.
So let's assume for the moment that the panel agreed with you on that point. What's your position with respect to the absence of argument on the takings clause?
I believe that the argument on the takings clause is that they are, that the statute existed when they lent money. Unlike every other case that they have cited, that the property interest existed prior to the existence of the statute. That isn't what happened here. They lent money after the statute was in place. The cease and desists were in place. This is a covenant running with the land. The obligation to pay is a covenant running with the land. And what they don't have is evidence. They talk about first in time, first in right. And they took away my rights. We are not a common law state. We're a recording. We're a record. We're a race notice state. We have been since 1861. We're not a common law state. First in time, first in right means I don't have to record anything and I still win. First in time, first in right is common law. We're a race notice state. That was done away with a century and a half ago. What we have now is CC&Rs, which is what allows you to get assessments. That obligation runs with the land. It exists before the deed of trust. This is not a case where the deed of trust existed prior to the statute, first of all. So they have nothing to lose. They made a choice to lend money here. Second, the legislature strictly avoided takings when they enacted the statute because it didn't apply to HOAs that existed prior to 1992, January 1st, 1992. It didn't apply to deeds of trust that already existed on the property at that time. So they avoided the takings. I think they understood what a takings would mean at that point. As for Armstrong, here you had the government taking away the actual property on the material men. But what you don't have in any of those cases is a means to protect yourself. Nothing. Here the bank has multiple means to protect itself. So nothing was taken from them. They lost it through their own inaction. But even Judge Gordon in the U.S. District Court, recently looking at this argument, the takings argument, without saying that he actually believed that it was a taking, said that, quote me, in U.S. Bank v. SFR Investments, 2016 Westlaw 1248704, so March 28, 2016 order, that to the extent the bank is looking for just compensation, saying that its property was taken without just compensation because of the enactment of the statute, they haven't sought redress from the state. That's who has unjust compensation. The HOA is a private actor. It exercised a private remedy with a private trustee simply according to the procedure set forth in the statute. So I don't think there's any taking here at all, Your Honor. Nothing was affected here as a taking. The government isn't involved in this at all. The government didn't take anything. It enacted a statute. They say it absolutely took their deed of trust. We don't know that. Again, the right to collect assessments in the lien could be in the CC&Rs prior. This is not a first-in-time, first-in-right. It would have depended on what existed at the time. And to say that absolutely there were no HOAs that existed at the time prior to 1991 that would have been prior to their deed of trust, there's no evidence of that. I can't tell you one way or the other. But to simply say that this statute affected a taking, I don't think that they get there. As far as their argument about 107090, and I don't know if that is a question before this court, I believe that that doesn't, that's a non-starter. To interpret the statute the way they want you to, you have to write out certain provisions, specifically subsection 3 and 4 of 107090. And second, you have to ignore the constitutional avoidance doctrine. And that's one thing they never bring up in their papers because they know they lose under it. If you can interpret it one of two ways, you must interpret it constitutionally. Small engine that they rely on, the holding of that case is not that this type of statute is unconstitutional. It's that this type of statute, even if you ignore 107090, this type of statute is constitutional when read with the recording statutes for a state actor to find somebody. That's the holding of the case. That you use the constitutional avoidance doctrine to avoid finding it unconstitutional, and the Louisiana statute doesn't have 107090 in it. Finally, Your Honor, as for waiver, I believe they waived any right to challenge the sale. Again, they didn't ask for 56F relief. This court shouldn't give it to them. They shouldn't be sent back for a better record. They had a chance to bring some evidence to raise a material question of fact. They didn't. Not an affidavit, not a scintilla of evidence. Was before the trial court to challenge the sale itself, except the constitutional arguments. And we believe that those are non-starters with Protean, as this court has said. With that, we believe that this court should affirm. It should not give the banks another bailout for doing nothing, for ignoring the rules, for ignoring the law, and hoping that the courts will find them a way out for things that they just didn't do. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Mr. Jacobs? Why don't you begin by clarifying the point on the commercial reasonableness question. What evidence was tendered in the summary judgment papers that would indicate that the sale was not commercially reasonable?
Yes, Your Honor. In the papers below, the sale price was one indicia that was discussed, which we recognize is not conclusive, but is part of this state's law in analyzing it. But her entire attack on 56F, there should have been evidence, is completely wrong, because the legal theory they moved under, it was essentially a motion for judgment on the pleadings. And all they did was say, the bank has no standing and is not allowed to argue this point, and SFR doesn't let you argue the point. That's all they argued. It's ironic that counsel argues waiver, because that's all they ever said in the court below. So the idea is fanciful that our client should have run in and provided an affidavit as if they had made a sensible shadow wood type motion that goes to fraud, unfairness, and oppression. They did no such thing. And they're asking this court, having not done it below, having not discussed it in their briefs at all, to say, oh, well, the bank should have known, because it's a bank and it's all on them. The bank should have figured out to put in an affidavit as if we made an imaginary motion that we never brought.
It appears that the district court agreed with that argument in the motion because it says in paragraph 2 of its order, based on the holding in SFR versus U.S. Bank, the court finds there's no genuine issues of material fact in disputing that summary judgment is appropriate. So it appears as though the basis of the court's decision in granting summary judgment was in the pure application of what it believed SFR held.
And that takes us, Justice Hudson, back to where I was when I started, which is that the very terse, it seems as though they led the district court into error, because footnote 6 in SFR leaves that open to be argued, like I was discussing with Your Honors before, and the decision seems to treat it.
Wouldn't you be obligated, in the opposition to that motion, to say something about what factually is raised about the commercial reasonableness of this sale? I mean, it's one thing to say in opposition to the summary judgment motion, I don't think SFR goes that far, but if the judge doesn't agree with you, or if this court agreed with you, wouldn't we have to say something else in opposition to the motion about what's commercially defective?
I think if they only provide a defective legal theory, essentially as if under Rule 12c, that if rebutted that would be sufficient, I agree it would be even better, Your Honor, but I don't think it's necessary when they don't offer any correct legal theory, and they clearly did not.
So you're saying that the traverse of the motion for summary judgment was focused on the singular legal question about the application of SFR?
And also upon their false claim, their incorrect claim, their erroneous claim, that the bank had no standing and wasn't allowed to even say that. That was at pages 153 and 4, I think, in the record. That's all they say. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think her argument extends a bit too far.
Does that not argue against the classic standard for opposition to a motion for summary judgment?
I don't think so, Justice Sotomayor.
There's no issue of material impact.
I don't think so, Justice Sotomayor, because often we see litigants just bring what are essentially barely disguised motions directly at purely legal issues that aren't very factually contingent. And we did discuss a fact in terms of the sale price being under 10%, and we did also talk about the possibility that that could indicate unfairness. But again, the record wasn't developed, and they did not show that there was a lack of issue as to the circumstances of the sale. This whole discussion is about why didn't we put in evidence specifically about its circumstances, and they have not.
That's your burden, I think. No.
And they have the burden to show the absence of an issue, which we then have to rebut. And I'm saying they only made two bad legal arguments that aren't correct. So that's at least our position. Everything that she said was not in their briefs and is waived. I must say that before sitting down. The entire exposition about Armstrong and takings, while interesting, is completely not found in their brief. And, you know, this idea that the bank had means to protect itself, well, that's new. The idea that there's a state action lacking there is not in their briefs, and it's wrong. Under the Stop the Beach case, we've cited to you in other cases that are before you currently, takings does not look very extensively at state action in particular. And as your question to counsel brought out, Justice, essentially, their argument is to collapse with the deed, to collapse all inquiries into the deed in the SFR case. And we think that's wrong. Thank you very much for your time.
Any other questions by my colleagues? Did you have any other thought you were trying to wrap up? I know you were trying to match the time, but I want you to finish your thought.
Merely that we think the due process arguments and the interpretation arguments that were raised, new cases, new ideas, none of that is in the briefs. And if it was an unpublished decision that said they waived these issues and it had no precedential value, that would make a lot of sense to me as a lawyer, because none of it's in their briefs. And it's hard to know what to do when a litigant comes to you with important constitutional questions and cites no cases and spends two pages. It's very hard to reply to that, Your Honors.
Okay. I'd like to thank counsel for your excellent briefing and arguments today. It's always a pleasure to have your learned thoughts and input. The case will stand submitted.